Welcome to the PhD Podcast. I'm Rhett. PhD, the path to happy destinations. Or maybe it should be path to happy destiny. The title of the podcast is Just Like My Life, a work in progress. This podcast is about how I'm living a life of unconditional sobriety. What does that mean? There are no conditions I will ever use alcohol or drugs again. People in addiction don't have to be alone. There's a whole community that are willing to help and support you find recovery. Who am I? I'm not a doctor, psychologist, or a healthcare professional. I'm just a guy who now lives in recovery. Hopefully we can break down the stigma associated with addiction and mental health. I hope you enjoy this episode of the PhD Podcast. And we're live. My guest today on PhD is a mother of three neurodiverse boys, recently diagnosed with ADHD, and has been sober for 3 years. The sober, loving radical, Nancy Evans. Thanks for being here today, Nancy.
Thank you. Thanks so much for inviting me.
I guess we have a few things in common. I have ADHD as well, and definitely struggled with substances in the past. Looking back as a child with undiagnosed ADHD, what were you like?
Not what you'd expect, actually. At school, I went under the radar. I kept quiet. I kept my head down. There was a lot of stuff I couldn't keep up with, and I just blagged it. You know, one of my very early memories is being at primary school, asked, we had to form two lines, those that could tell the time and those that couldn't tell the time. And I couldn't tell the time, and I went and stood in the line of the kids that could tell the time because I was embarrassed. I never learnt my times tables. So, you know, there were always certain things at school that I really struggled with. And I just kind of hid. And because I wasn't like the typical image of a crazy ADHD boy that's bouncing off the walls, no one noticed. And I always tried so hard. And I was only ever like a C grade student at school. And until I started doing my A-levels and I chose subjects that I loved, I chose to do English, drama and art. And I could learn all of a sudden, you know, I could learn lines, I could learn Shakespeare, I could write essays, I could do stuff. And it kind of surprised me. And I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed those 2 years. And then I went off to do a degree and in a big lecture hall with hundreds of people and distractions and noise. And I'd come out of a lecture an hour and a half later going, well, what was that all about? Like nothing, like as if I had not been in the room. And I was drinking a lot as well, which probably didn't help. So, yeah, there was quite a sense of failure because I knew that I wasn't stupid. I knew that I was bright and capable, but I just didn't know what was going on and why I failed. That's how it felt. So I left. I left after a year. I knew I was going to get emotional. Yeah, I guess there's still some... I don't know, sadness, maybe? Lost opportunities, I think. That's how it felt, of what I could have done. Yeah. So, yeah, I left and I started working, and I was good at office work because I could write a good letter, you know, and I knew how to people please, and I was very diplomatic. I used to work for a high street fashion company in their head office, and I was a PA there to the managing director, and he was explosive, really fiery, sweary guy, and I just handled him really well. He really liked me. I was the most awful PA. I was so disorganized. You know, the actual jobs that he wanted me to do, I was just really not very good at, but I could handle him really well and smile and make him laugh and make his coffee and just I was easy for him to be around. I was like, people would come to see him and they'd come to me first and say like, oh, what kind of mood is he in? And I could just like bridge the gap between him and other people and field phone calls. And I got by, but it wasn't stimulating or, you know, mentally fulfilling. And I left there and went and worked for a marketing advertising production company in the West End. And my old boss said to me, when I told him I was leaving, he kind of knew, you know, he knew that I was losing interest. And I told him where I was going and he said, oh, Jesus, advertising, they're the biggest bunch of wankers you'll ever know. And I got there and it was horrible. They were very hostile. They didn't sack me, but we agreed to part ways and they gave me 3 months' salary. And I just did a complete turnaround and started a gardening business and started working on my own and having freedom and driving around in my van. And I loved it. I loved that feeling of independence and freedom from that. And I kind of did that really until I had a family. That's quite a long answer to one question, isn't it?
That's totally okay. I loved it. Yeah, I had a landscape company as well. My education's in landscape design, so I understand using some of those. Like, I mean, every day is a different day. So for my ADHD, I always want something new every day. And every yard or every landscape that I built was something different, and there was a new challenge in it. So there was never the same thing twice. And then I look back and try and understand now why I fell into that and it was easy for me. I understand it's because I have ADHD, I can't do the same thing over and over and over again. And I can just get bored. Yeah. I sympathize with you when you say, you know, I get stuck in a job, I'm just doing the same thing every day. And, you know, I'm dealing with this grumpy fella and, you know, I'm good at that. Yeah. But that's not enough. And so you around a bit, and I understand, you know, from my ADHD, what that's like.
Yeah.
You know, when you were a child, like, what were the biggest struggles associated with your ADHD?
It was, so mine is much more inattentive. So it was paying attention. It was zoning out and losing like track of what was going on in a lesson. And then never quite being able to catch up because I felt too humiliated to keep saying, what am I supposed to be doing? So falling behind, really, because if I wasn't really interested, I would zone out and my mind would be elsewhere or many other places except for that lesson. And then also like working memory, so remembering facts. Like, I loved history. I had a great history teacher and we did modern history, so there was loads of stuff I was interested in, but when it came to doing the exam, I couldn't remember it. I still don't. There's loads of things that I've learned that just don't remember. I can't recall them. And then randomly, I always remember Latin plant names from the gardening course that I did. These just like things that I think I've forgotten, and I'll look at something and all of a sudden out pops this long Latin plant name that's a bit random and a bit of a shame because there's loads of other stuff I wish I could remember. And so revising for exams never went very well. I really tried, and it was frustration, you know, knowing that I new stuff and I had understood it, but I just couldn't recall it in that moment to get it down on the paper. Mm. And my eldest son is going through a similar experience now to a degree. He was home educated until November last year and decided he wanted to go to college. So he's doing a lot of catching up. But he's, still the same thing. And even though he now has a diagnosis, you know, I photocopied it, I sent it to the college, I've spoken to them, I've explained, and, you know, he still gets recently a teacher saying, I'm so fed up of people that can't concentrate, you know, in the lesson. Mm. It's just, it's hard because it's invisible, you know, and people just assume that you are not paying attention or you're being a distraction to the other kids and or you don't care. And it's not the case at all. I know that he cares. I know that I cared. And I know that he'll get on eventually. He'll find the right thing and he'll do really well. But at 16, when you're a teenager, you want to be like your peers. You want to be successful in, you know, the way that you improve your intelligence, which is this like jumping through hoops for exams, which drives me a bit crazy, but he wanted to do it, so I'm just supporting him through it. He's doing motor vehicle engineering as well, which he loves. Hmm. Which I'm not surprised about with the amount of Lego he's he was so into Lego and so into pulling things apart and putting them back together. He's got a really 3D brain, you know. Minecraft. He's just played endless Minecraft. All my kids have loved it, actually, but I can just see how it fits with him and how it must be for him when he's working on an engine at college. Mm. It's just easy to him. It's natural.
You know, when you said that he has to, like, you know, try to fit in, and it's like, for me, it was the same thing, you know, learning how to, like, mask, because I was the bouncy kid that couldn't sit still, and, you know, you had teachers, why can't you sit still? Just sit still and pay attention, and, like, I can't do either one of those things, and I had no idea why. So, I learned how to, like, sit and mask and just be able to, like, hold myself still, and, like, even to this day, I find myself doing it. Without even thinking about it, just holding myself still so I could fit into the room and not have to be the guy that's, you know, moving around and bouncing around and stuff. Did you have those issues as a child? No.
I it's funny. We're kind of split. So my eldest son is a lot more like me. It's the inattentiveness, which is actually just loads of attention in loads of different areas. All at the same time. It's not a lack of attention. It's just so much attention and not being able to channel it, particularly if the thing that you're supposed to be channeling your attention towards is not interesting to you. And that's what school is most of the time. It's having to learn stuff that you're not interested in. My middle son, who's 14, is much more hyperactive. So he's hyperactive, impulsive, and he's been out of school since he was six, so he's not been forced to sit still or sit at a desk. And so he doesn't mask, and he paces, like even just having a chat with me, he paces backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards. And I try not to ask him to stand still, but sometimes it's really difficult, particularly if it's in your, you know, peripheral vision. It kind of makes, I pick it up and it starts to make me feel a bit nervy. And my husband is very, he has never been diagnosed and he doesn't identify as having ADHD. He's just like, whatever I am, it works for me. I'm good with it. I'm me. I'm great. I do a great job. I've got loads of energy. And he's like that driven by a motor thing that they say a lot of people with ADHD have. So I'm like, maybe there's something going on, but you know, it doesn't matter. And actually, once you're an adult, it doesn't matter, because we find our way, right? We find our fit and we learn the way we need to learn. And that's what he's done, my husband. But for kids that are still trying to, you know, it's like trying to bash a square peg into a round hole with the education system. That's when it's hard. And that's why I offered, I didn't get my children diagnosed when they were younger. I chose to take them out of the education system. And we used the philosophy of unschooling, which is not always, people assume it just means you don't go to school. That's not the case. It's learning, but not the school way. That's learning without school. It's educating yourself without school. So it's, you know, lots of conversations, lots of like deep diving into their own interests. For my boys, it was loads of gaming. You know, they learned to read and write from playing Minecraft on a home ed server. Their vocabulary is amazing just because of being around us and talking and watching loads of stuff on YouTube. And it's a little bit radical. You know, that's what I chose because that it's just, it felt right to me. You know, no, there were no real strict rules or bedtimes, or we just lived together and lived together as a really cohesive family unit and talked to them a lot and explained, well, if you know, you're not feeling great today, what, you know, what could we do differently? What would have worked better? Just kind of problem solving with them, I think, to help them understand their needs. And it has paid off in that I've got three very different boys with all slightly different ways, brains working in slightly different ways. That's the neurodiverse element. You know, they're not the predominant neurotype, the type that school is geared up to. That's not my kids. That's why, you know, I describe them as neurodiverse. ADHD moment. I've lost my train of thought and my thread. But yeah, we lived together. We learned together. We played a lot together. They followed their interests. They developed their own sense of self and their own personalities. And I don't think they quite get it yet, how good that's been for them. But I think they will once they get through this teenage bit.
Well, I mean, once they understand what they actually went through and how different it was from everybody else, because they're just inside of their own little world. They don't really see how different it was for them. And I'm sure they'll learn to appreciate it in the end. You describe them as neurodiverse. Can you just explain to everybody what that means in reference to your family?
Yeah. Well, you know, everybody's brain functions differently, slightly differently, but there is a predominant neurotype. This is my lovely TikTok friend, Rachel Asaurus, who is autistic and has ADHD. She's studying autism at degree level. She told me that now we say the predominant neurotype, not neurotypical, because that means that, I don't know, people that aren't neurotypical are somehow deficit. So our brains are diverse, and that, because it covers a wide range. It's not just ADHD and it's not just autism. My youngest son, I'm not sure whether he has ADHD, but he definitely has a sensory processing disorder, it's called. So he tastes things very differently. His sensory needs are just so very different. You know, he can't, things have to be separate on his plate. So his tastes are very limited and he eats quite a small range of things that he likes. And if I couldn't understand it when he was younger, like he would have the only sandwich he would eat was tuna, sweet corn, mayonnaise in sliced brown bread. If he went to someone else's house and they offered him a sandwich, and even if they made it exactly as I, that what I've just told you, the same description, he would bite it and go, oh, like, literally, it have to spit it out because the bread was not the same brand of bread. Like, he didn't know, he couldn't see what they were doing. Mm-hmm. But his ability to taste things in a very different way. And also with him, it's things like physical pain is different. He finds small things very, very painful. And it's partly his age that he's shower avoidant. He doesn't like having too many showers, but it's also he's 9. He was having a shower. I said, he was complaining, oh, how long do I have to go in for? Like, okay, not too long, you know, just a couple of minutes. It'll be quick, it'll be fine. And whilst he was in the shower, I said, so what does it feel like when you have a shower? And he went, oh, it's like loads of needles going into my body. And I was like, oh my God. Well, yeah, that kind of explains.
That's a good reason not to hop in the shower, right?
Yeah. Yeah,
I think I was the complete opposite. I loved having baths and showers. I could live in the water. You know, it was different. Like, it was soothing for me when it's the opposite. And, you know, you don't recognize that sometimes as a parent, understanding. But do you think understanding your challenges a bit as a mother, as a child, you know, and now as a mother, recognizing in your children and helping them understand, like, when did you realize that your sons had some traits that you may have had as a child?
My eldest son, we knew quite early on that he was different. He thought differently. There was something different about him. I remember he was about 2.5 and we were talking to him and he just kind of went, he was seeing something, you know, and he was chuckling and then he was frowning. And my husband and I just like touched each other and sat with him and gently asked afterwards, you know, where did you go? And he was just, you know, it was like a daydream. It was like it was this, his mind wandering. And so we kind of knew, but it didn't really unfold until year at school. It would have been year 3 was when it got really difficult, when he was 8. But it started, and it was when he started to do more sit-down desk work, you know, when it was sit down, stay still, you know, do this writing. Handwriting was a real struggle. It looked physically painful. And he would always draw, you know, in writing exercises. His teacher always said, you know, Rudy spent far too much time on the drawing. He didn't get any writing done. He was just creative. And writing looked physically painful when he tried to do it. But when we took him out of school and he started playing Minecraft and chatting to his friends, and he had that real drive and motivation to, Mom, how do you spell creeper? Mom, how do you spell? And that's how he learned to read and to spell, with me looking over his shoulder and saying, oh, that says, oh, he's saying this. And just, you know, that real desire and real urge to communicate made it happen. So, yeah, we knew, and the school just kept saying, they kept brushing it off. I kept going in. And then it got to a point where his self-esteem was plummeting and he was coming home raging and saying things like, I hate my brain. That was tough, really tough. Very emotional. And emotional outbursts, and he would take it out on his younger brother, who was 21 months younger. And it was, I think, saying things to him that he felt about himself. Oh, you're so stupid. You're an idiot. You know, really things that just, because they're great friends and they've always been really close, but there've been times where, you know, it's been a bit fiery, and I guess that's probably going to always be the case with brothers. But at that particular moment, when it was going on around school and after school, I just thought, this can't go on. And, you know, I started doing things like, first of all, I wrote the school a letter and I said, I'm giving my son an exemption from homework. He's 8 years old. Like, he doesn't need to be doing projects about the Victorians in his home time. Like, when he's at home with us as a family, he needs to be able to have family time. Okay, I'll help him with his spellings. I'll help him with some maths, but no big, like, written projects. Because I kind of read up about this, and you can, right? You can say this is their time to be in their family and have fun. And he was, like, struggling over it so much and avoiding it and procrastinating. And I was making him sit back down, and it was ruining, like, every evening. And it would go on and on, night after night, trying to get these bloody projects finished for school. And that was the beginning of the end, really, because it didn't go down too well. And then he had two teachers that were doing a job share, and they weren't great. And they called me in and they said that he was disruptive one parents' evening, and complained that they would tell the class, they would give everybody their instructions and tell them what to do. And he is the only one that comes back and says, what am I supposed to be doing? And I just thought, right, yeah, he's an inconvenience to you. I knew, and I was pretty sure it was ADHD, but I didn't, at that point, I didn't want to give him a label. I suppose I didn't understand it fully. He was having extra tuition, and my lovely tutor, who is now, is tutoring him again now for his maths GCSE. She's lovely. She said, I don't know, Nancy, if you've heard of unschooling. So now I'm a teacher and I'm an ex-primary school teacher, but I'm not going to send my daughter to school. And she lent me all these books. She's like, go and read these. By a guy called John Holt, one of them. It was like How Children Learn and How Children Fail, different books. And it was really eye-opening. And I thought, okay, I could do that. Like, I couldn't do sit-down school at home. I could do this, like, learning through interests and passions and being a family and going camping, and I could do that. And I gave him the option. I said, you know, I could take you out of school. You could learn from home. He went, yeah, I'll do it. Well, okay.
It was incredible.
He was so ready for it.
It's like, well, kudos to you for, you know, recognizing it and then making the time to make the change for them, for him. You know, I only dream of, like, you know, at school, I was only dreaming of leaving so I could go do my sport or leave to go play or leave to just, you know, wherever, because it was painful to be in those classrooms for, you know, the amount of time and, you know, just sitting there going, you know, looking at the clock. And it's difficult as a parent, because, I mean, not everybody has the ability to just pull the kids out of school. But I love that you wrote the letter to say, yeah, no more homework. I'm like, I wish my parents had done that. I mean, you know, it was homework, and then just, like, I mean, it was like school, sport, homework, bed, and weekends were filled with, like, in between homework, trying to catch up and trying to get ahead, and it was never fun. It was difficult, and, you know, it sounds like you're taking their learning differences and turning them to advantages, and I think that's beautiful. You know,
I had a gut instinct that his mental health and self-esteem had to come first. I'm like, that has got to be a priority. Everything else can happen whenever, Like, you can do open university degrees. You can be learning for the rest of your life. You can do GCSEs. You can go to college. You can do any of that at any time if you have good mental health, if you have good self-esteem, if you're happy as a person. And yeah, that's how it fell. That's how it broke down in my head. And I suppose because neither my husband or I have got, you know, this great academic background. But my husband's very, very successful and very driven. And I got by and I've survived and I've thrived. I think I've thrived despite, you know, not having a degree and not always getting things right and changing jobs. And it's a long journey. And that school piece is just not entirely necessary. I think a lot of it is childcare, really.
Yeah, I agree. You know, yeah, well, it is. Like, I mean, it's just like the factory system. It's like, you know, parents got to go to the factory and the kids have to go somewhere. And so, and, you know, it's just the way we've looked at things for such a long time as society. And, you know, now it's the norm and this is the way we do things. And two income families is now the norm. And so it's, you know, society just keeps changing. I think that this pandemic and / you know, stay at home kind of has changed the look on how we are going to look at things in the future. And, you know, online is now the norm. And so I've been learning online for a long time. You know, YouTube was school for me, like for like a long time. Like, I mean, I needed to learn how to do a website. I just go on YouTube. I need to learn how to take a photo with a new camera. I went on YouTube, was class. I didn't have to go to a college or a institution to figure some of those things out. So you recently got diagnosed with ADHD. What was the point from, you know, did you just want to find out if it was actually in you or like, what was the,
yeah, I think so. Like, My eldest son was diagnosed 2 years ago. And at that point, I was like, right, okay, we are so similar. There's something going on. And I think I just needed to know. I needed to know for my own, to understand my past, what at the time I felt were my educational failures, which aren't, you know, they're not failures. I may not have passed the exams, but I learned a whole load of stuff. So I needed to know, and I didn't think I was going to take any medication, but then I decided to try, and it actually has really, really helped. No, actually, let me rewind a little bit. I always thought I used to call myself chaotic and disorganized and scatty. And I always blamed that on drinking. I thought, you know, because I drink, it's because I'm always hungover. I'm either slightly pissed or hungover or, yeah, in some kind of, you know, state related to alcohol. And I think I kind of pinned it all on that. And I thought, and when I stopped drinking, I expected to function a bit more, I don't want to say normally, I expected to be able to do things in a certain way, and I still wasn't able to. Mm-hmm. And I was still zoning out, you know, and bless my husband, I know it drives him mad, but sometimes he'll be talking to me and I've lost him and I'd think, oh shit, and I have to say, I'm really sorry, I've zoned out, can you say that again? Mm-hmm. and that was still happening. So yeah, I just thought, okay, there's something else, it's not just the alcohol.
Yeah, I recently went and got re-diagnosis, because I had a diagnosis a long time ago, when I was an adult, early adulthood. And then I just recently went back and I got a brain scan done. So I got a QEEG done. And, you know, the diagnosis comes out as you have a ring of fire ADHD. I'm like, what is that? I'm like, that can't be good. So I'm like, so I started Googling, of course, you know, I'm like, okay, thanks. And, you know, away went with this diagnosis. And, you know, understanding it is one is something that, you know, just how do I work with it? Like, what's the best things for me? How do I find my, you know, what's challenging to me? How can I, you know, take a negative and turn it a positive? I always say it's like my ADHD is a superpower. I just now have to know how to use it. Like, if you don't know how to use your superpower, like, what are you going to do with it? Right. And I look back at my drinking and, you know, I started as a young age as well. I started like, you know, 12, 13 just drinking, you know, but, I think it was like a self-medication. Like it was, you know, cause it's like this stops some of those, things, you know, the ADHD characteristics, the hyperactivity stuff, it was like, it slowed it down. And then like, you know, so I was self-medicating. Do you think at your young age, you were self-medicating with the alcohol, or was it?
I think I probably was. There was probably some trauma. Some kind of childhood trauma that you know, my mum and dad split when I was two, so there was painful, you know, a feeling of grief, I think, and loss of a relationship I never had. I mean, I knew my dad, and I saw him occasionally. It wasn't then like it often is now when parents separate, you know, both parents still remain very involved. My dad moved away and he's a musician. Well, he's finally retired. I think he retired at 82. He's a jazz bass player. I mean, that was his world, you know, music and golf. And I saw him once or twice a year, maybe, but there was not that bond. There was not what I had with my mum. So there was a lot of feelings of sadness and inadequacy that I think stemmed from that. And that fuck it feeling, like, all right, I'll try that. Fuck it. Why not? There was a lot of that. And sensation seeking, maybe, really wanting to try what different things felt like. From, you know, starting, and it's a really horrible thought now, but like solvents, and not to an excess, but like an experimental thing going on when I was about 12, 13, drinking at 14. I didn't really, wasn't particularly into drugs. I mean, I had a family, it was a, smoking weed and stuff happened, and I was aware of it, and I just wasn't that interested because it wasn't didn't seem like a big deal to me. You know, I knew adults that did this thing, and I wasn't desperate to try it, although I think I did when I was like 14, 15, but yeah, I didn't really get into it. So there's a social drinking. When I was at school doing my A-levels, we used to go to the pub at lunchtime and drink, and it was like the early 90s then. So I was drinking pints with the guys. Drugs, recreational drugs, that kind of happened not until my mid-20s, and that was with like the rave scene and festivals and partying, and that was fun for a while. But eventually I met my husband and I wanted to be a mum. I wanted to slow down, have a family. That wasn't a problem for me. I wasn't really desperate. I wasn't like really needing to self-medicate. But that escalated in motherhood. It definitely escalated when I had my kids. And again, feelings of failure, feelings of not being good enough. Felt like I was getting it wrong. I didn't know that they were different. And I mean, it's, some of the stories are just hilarious, like the stuff that they got up to. And I was so tired because they didn't sleep and they kept waking up through the night. And I was just wrung out, you know, 21 months apart. I fell asleep one day and came downstairs and they had like these long kebab skewers that they were sword fighting with, like really sharp, pointy things. And they were covered in coal dust. They'd had them up the chimney like Laurel and Hardy. They were like pretending to be chimney sweeps. So, yeah, it was an exhausting time. And they lived to make each other laugh. They lived for each other's attention and entertainment. And they couldn't give a shit what I said or how angry I got or how much I shouted or how much I threatened them. I mean, I tried everything. You know, I was never going to be a physical. I was never going to kind of slap them. Or I think I did once as a real shock. I think one of them bit me or something, and it was like a sharp smack on the bum, and I hated it. It was a horrible feeling. So there was a lot of stress going on. There was a lot of stress of trying to handle these two wild, beautiful, funny, crazy, energetic bundles of energy. And the self-medicating definitely started happening then in the evenings, where I just had to wind it right down and just shut off the noise and get my nervous system back into like, well, what I thought was a regulated state. It wasn't. It was just like numbed with alcohol. And yeah, so it was evening drinking, which, you know, over years, your tolerance builds, you drink more. So yeah, it was not easy. Oh, you know, they were happy. We were happy. It wasn't like desperately awful, but my nervous system was really out of whack. And the lack of sleep as well, and then the feelings of not being enough, not getting it right, and just wanting to be a great parent. I wanted to be the best mum I could be, and I just felt like I wasn't hitting it, I wasn't getting it right. And talk to them sometimes about that, and you know, we laugh about it together. I'm sort of lighthearted about it. I don't kind of, you know, give them any kind of, you've got no idea what you put me through, because it wasn't like that. There were some great moments. But yeah, I think that's when my drinking became a maladaptive coping mechanism, and it wasn't about being sociable or having fun or anything like that. It was about coping with the stress. Yeah, and slowly things began to change. So I had those two boys quite close in age, and I thought, no more children. Never again. You couldn't pay me to have another child. That was difficult, and I'm not going back to that. So I sold all my baby stuff, sold all the clothes, all the equipment, and I'm one of three, and my husband's one of three. And somewhere in the back of my brain, I was like, three is a magic number. And just when, you know, I was approaching, well, I was 39, I said to my husband, should we have another one? And he was like, yeah, all right then. And my third son was born a week before my 40th birthday. And when I was pregnant with him, and I was trying to get my other two ready for school, the usual crazy stress, like, where are your shoes? Where's your book bag? and they're chasing around the house and like the go, 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 the stress of trying to get them out. I was always late at the school gate, always in trouble. Like teachers looking at, you know, looking at their watches, and there's, you know, me completely flustered, pushing them. I just, when I was pregnant, I was like, I can't keep doing this. This isn't healthy. This stress that I'm feeling is not good for my unborn child. I kind of instinctively knew I had to do something differently. And slowly things started to change. My parenting style started to change. I found, I don't know what you would call him, a guy, he's an author called Alfie Cohn, maybe psychiatrist, and he wrote a book called Parenting with Punishment or Reward, and it really shifted my perspective. I just changed. Yeah, I leaned into what different terms, gentle parenting, respectful parenting. So I wanted to stop all the shouting and all the hollering and the slightly aggressive, manipulative, I don't know if that's a bit harsh of a word. Probably, it's probably manipulative. Like, if you don't do this, by the time I count to 10, this is going to happen, you know, that kind of stuff. I wanted to stop all of that. It didn't feel right to me. And actually, that was the only tool I had when I had to get them to school. But once they were out of school, I didn't have to. I was like, okay, if you don't want to get up, it might mean that we can't go swimming. But if you're all right with that, then you don't have to get up. I'm not going to rush you. And it all just suddenly, it all calmed down. So I found what I needed by making the changes.
Mm-hmm. So your drinking ramped up between the second and third child, and then it obviously you stopped at some point. And then when did it pick back up, or did it pick back up after that?
Yeah, it did. I mean, I stopped during pregnancy. I was breastfeeding, so in the early days when my youngest son was very little, I stopped and I would maybe have like one glass of wine with a meal, and then I kind of judged it in between feeding and stuff. But my husband and I, you know, we enabled each other's bad habits. You know, we met working behind a bar. We partied together, we drank a lot together, we did drugs together, and we had a lot of fun. And it was, in a way, it was the foundation of our relationship. You know, it was what we did. And once all the drugs went, drinking was, you know, what we had left. And it felt like, it was my identity. It was who we were as a couple. It was who I was. I'm a bit rebellious. I like to party. And I kept trying to control it, kept trying and trying. And he would say to me, "Do you want a drink?" I'm like, no, I'm all right. And then before I knew it, we both had a drink because I wasn't, you know, I tried to say no, but I wasn't very convincing. I was like, well, if you're having one, I'll go on then. Whenever I said, okay, let's not drink during the week. Let's just not. We'll wait the weekend. Then it'd be like Wednesday night. So we'd drink Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday, have Monday off, hungover, tired, have Tuesday off, starting to get a little bit twitchy, a little bit, oh, God, this is a struggle. And then by Wednesday, I would cook something like a beef stew. I'm like, we need red wine with beef stew. We can't have red meat, not have red wine. You know, all those excuses. And now from everything I'm learning, like day three is the day when the alcohol is, you know, day three, four for detoxing, when it's coming out of your body. It always got me. So yeah, making all the rules around my own drinking, breaking all the rules. And I just, yeah, I got sick of it because I couldn't say no to it. And I didn't like that. I didn't like the fact that alcohol was making me break my own rules myself. It didn't sit right with me. And I think I said it on a recent TikTok, you know, there were a couple of little things. And one of them was I went out dancing. I did a lot of Lindy Hop, and it was a lovely social scene. And lots of people didn't drink. And when I was drinking, I couldn't understand it. I'm like, well, you're weird. Like, don't want to be your friend if you're not drinking. So ridiculous. And I would drink one, and if I had to drive, have like one large glass of wine, which was probably still too much. But I went out one night. Once I moved out of London, I didn't dance as much. I would go back maybe once a month, once every 2 months, because it was quite a heavy night. It's like over an hour's drive, then dancing, you know, for a good 3 or 4 hours, and then driving back. And I went out, the Christmas thing, everyone was dressed up like a great live swing band. And I saw some old friends, and one of them offered to buy me a drink. And I said, I'd love one, thank you, I'll have a gin and tonic. And it was a single, and I was just like, oh, that's not, you know, that's, oh, I felt really conflicted because I felt really ungrateful. I was I need a double. And of course, you know, you can't say, so thanks, James, that's great, you know. And when once he was out of earshot or view, I went back to the bar, can you stick another shot in there for me? And I just thought, that's not right. Mm-hmm. That's not nice. It didn't feel nice. I didn't feel good. And then I had a birthday, and I bought loads of cards that had pictures of gin bottles on the front, and I was bought a bottle of gin. And again, I felt slightly a lack of gratitude. I was like, is that all you see when you see me? Is that all my personality has become? Someone that loves drinking gin. And actually, yeah, it probably had. It had taken over my identity in a way. And I just didn't like it. And I didn't know how to stop. I didn't think there was a way to stop. I thought the only thing I could do was to keep trying to suppress that desire for more. Mm-hmm. And it was what I didn't like about cocaine. It was that greediness, that the way it makes you want more and more and more. And it makes you lie, and it makes you, yeah, just horrible. And I was starting to, not to the same extreme, but with alcohol I was starting to feel that same thing. Mm-hmm. If I'm sharing a bottle of wine with someone, like real eye on making sure that I had my fair share. And it just wasn't pleasant.
So how'd you end up stopping? Like, that's the thing, right?
I had a lovely group of friends who I haven't seen for a while because of COVID, like a home ed group of friends, much to everybody's disbelief, homemade kids do socialize. And we knew loads of other families, and we would meet up, the kids would play football, we'd go and chat in the park. And there was my lovely friend Paula. We were chatting one day, and she just casually, somehow in conversation, she mentioned that she hadn't had a drink for 2 years. And I was like, tell me more. What do you mean? She was like, well, I never really drank very much, but, you know, I'd have a couple of beers every night. And at that point, I'm like, so you weren't, like, you didn't have a problem with alcohol, but you've stopped drinking. How does that work? because it just didn't enter my head that a nice, normal person with a great sense of humor, a person that I identified with, could be a non-drinker. Yeah, because I had this stupid belief, like, I don't trust people that don't drink. There's something weird about people that don't drink. What kind of bullshit is that? I mean, yeah, like, weird.
I have the same thing. I'm like, back in, you know, I was like, what do you mean you don't drink? And now I'm like one of those non-drinkers. But yeah. My thing was, I think it was, you know, my insecurity with my drinking habits, you know, saying, you know, people, you know, I'll never be like those, you know, I won't, you know, do that. But yeah.
Yeah.
So, sorry.
Yeah, I was just going to finish. Like, when she said that to me, I had this like real gut feeling, like, I want that. I want to be like you. I want to do that. I want to know what that feels like. I want to know what that freedom feels like, to be able to go on holiday and not drink, to be able to, you know, say no to a drink. I just had this real drive to be that person. I have told her, like, in the early days, that she was that thing, that the light bulb just went on. And yeah, from then I just went home and I said to my husband, I'm going to stop drinking. I didn't ask him. There was no conversation. How would you feel if? And he was like, oh, okay. All right. Well, where's that come from? So I explained, and he said, forever. And I was like, yeah, after this birthday, that's it. It was coming up to my 46th birthday. I'm going to stop drinking, and it's got to be forever. And he said, okay, well, you know, I'm not going to stop. And I was like, that's fine. You know, I'm not expecting you to stop. You do what is right for you, but please just don't offer me drinks, or, you know, don't try and get me to join you. We'll have to work out how it's going to work. But you know, I knew in my head that I couldn't put that on him as well. It had to be about me, and I was making the choice for myself. So it was nothing awful happened. No, you know, big disaster. I just almost was given permission, like, you can stop.
Yeah. For me, that sounds amazing. Cause I mean, no rock bottom, no nothing. But for me, it's like, I mean, for myself, it was, I drank alcoholically right from the beginning. And, you know, stopping was, when I was stopped, it was even worse than when I was drinking, the obsession and those things. So, I mean, I needed help. I couldn't do it on my own. Mm. And so, like, we categorize those drinkers, like, into the alcoholic, but I think there's like a huge segment of the population that falls into this gray area where they're not quite, you know, they don't need to go to treatment centers. They don't need to be in meetings all the time. They just stop, like you did, like you just turned it off and you said, I'm not going to do it anymore.
Yeah.
And your content on TikTok, you have a great TikTok account, by the way. I really appreciate it. Your content there is, you know, revolves around gray area drinking. And do you categorize yourself as a gray area drinker when you were drinking?
I didn't at the time. I didn't really know that. I thought I was a normal drinker. And I think a lot of drinkers do. They're normal drinkers. You know, lots of people contact me and message me, and they don't think that they have alcohol use disorder, but they might be drinking two bottles of wine a night, home on their own, maybe more. And they think they're drinking normally. And it's hard because, you know, it is so normalized. It's part, particularly in the UK, it's such a huge part of our culture. But people are beginning, particularly with COVID as well, people are beginning to realize it's slipping out of their control. Mm-hmm. I really want to keep sending that message that you know, you don't have to wait until it's too late. You don't have to wait until you're ill or your, you know, your mental health is really struggling, or you can stop at any point. And it's really fun as well. You know, life carries on once you're on an even keel. It's better. Life is better. It's more fun. It's more enjoyable. It's more rewarding. It's more authentic. Yeah, I can't believe I was so blinded by it. I was so, like, sold on the idea that alcohol was, you know, this big part of me and a big part of my life and really important.
Well, there's so much emphasis put on, like, mummy culture and drinking wine and, you know, mom needs a break, or you need a break from your life and here's the solution. And it's, you know, being sold to you and to, like, yeah, culture, like in culture, everyday culture, it's there. Comes down to it. Like, even finding a definition on gray area drinking, it was difficult to find one or two that kind of matched. There's the gray area on just what the definition is. There's plenty of definitions in the alcoholic section of, like, you know, this is what an alcoholic looks like. Mm-hmm. There wasn't much in the gray area, and I was trying to, you know, so I found two that were similar. One that said 7 or fewer drinks per week, 3 or fewer drinks on any day, but who drank more than one drink at least one day. So per week. So I mean, like, that, like, what does that mean? I'm like, so if you've had one drink twice in a week, you're in the gray area. And, you know, with the new research that's coming out, it's like, what level alcohol's okay. Like, when I was younger, it was like, you know, doctors say that one glass of wine a day, you know, helps you do this. And I was like, you know, was the thing they used to say about smoking, like, you know, doctors recommend this kind of smokes, like, you know, and now we look back and go, wow, that wasn't the case. And are we being sold as a society? Alcohol is a solution. And are we going to look back at, like, in two generations and go, what were they thinking?
Well, yeah, what were we doing? And that it really angers me, you know, that marketing to women of alcohol, and, you know, it is not a reward to put a toxin in your body when you've got young children to care for. What mums need is more support, more rest, you know, a more sort of even sharing of the workload and the emotional and the mental load of looking after kids and running a home and most cases juggling work as well. It's a lot of stress and it's a lot of pressure and a lot of attention being pulled in different directions. And mostly what mums need, it's a little bit of time to themselves to be able to go to the toilet and not be interrupted, you know, to be able to have a long, hot, relaxing bath, you know, maybe read a bit of a book or have some music on. That's what mums need, you know. They need more self-care and more understanding and to be told that they're doing a great job. They don't need alcohol at the end of the day. And sadly, you know, lots have got into a rut with it and it's quite hard to get out of. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's what I'm there for on TikTok.
Yeah. And why do you think it is as a society that we overlook the negative aspects of drinking and continue to do it? Like, you're in this gray area where you can stop at any time. Why do we just continue to do it? Like, what is going on there?
Well, yeah, it's probably lots of things. I was thinking today, you know, this analogy, it's like neural pathways in your brain. You know, we've been doing it for so long, often for decades. We associate everything with having a drink. You know, you're sad, you have a drink. You're happy, you have a drink. And any habit or any action repeated over time becomes a habit, and particularly with a substance like alcohol that delivers you a great whack of dopamine, you know, when you do it, not even when you're drinking it. For me, it was when I could hear the glug, glug, glug of the wine going in the glass. It was that, peace. That was just from the sound. Mm-hmm. And that creates those neural pathways, and it's that connection that you need to break in early habit change. And you can do that in different ways. And I get that feeling I get that feeling when I sit down on my sofa at the end of the day next to my husband, stroking the dog because he's always there in between us. When I go and sit in my garden and I listen to the birds, I just tune in to the sound of the leaves and the wind. It's just that we've always done it with alcohol, and we get the messages from society as well. When I first stopped drinking, I don't know if you noticed this, it just seemed to be everywhere. Like every novel that I read to try and distract myself, like the main character was necking vodka or, you know, always opening a bottle of Prosecco. I'm like, will you stop already? Like, I hadn't noticed it before, obviously, but when you stop drinking and you're trying to not drink, you just suddenly realize how pervasive it is in our culture. And that, again, is part of the reason, you know, it feels like everyone's doing it and that's what we do. So people carry on with those unhealthy habits.
Mm-hmm. So now that you're helping other people, if you started this training and specializing in addictive behaviors and helping other people, how's that journey? How did the journey begin for you, and why did you make that switch to do that?
It amazes me, really. It's the power of TikTok in so many ways. That's a really powerful app. I did my first post about giving up drinking in December. It was December the 18th. I remember I just thought, I could give people a couple of tips, like stop drinking. And that post just I won't say it went viral, because a lady of my age on TikTok is never going to like go viral, but it was like thousands of views, lots and lots of comments. People were really interested, and I did a couple of other posts and found that I actually enjoyed talking about it, and it's sort of snowballed. And I can't even really remember. I was just having lots of chats. There was lots of connection with people asking me for like book recommendations. I've got loads of quick literature, great, you know, book recommendations. But I could just, I could give a few of those recommendations to people. And I suppose I got a little bit hooked on that the pleasure, the reward of knowing that I was doing something that was helping people. Mm-hmm. And I do care. I'm a compassionate person, and I was able to use that as well. People telling me their stories and being the person that they spoke to, they'd never spoken to this stuff to anyone about. Mm-hmm. And being able to just go, I hear you, you know, it's all right. I don't know why that's making me cry.
I mean, a lot of people don't have the outlet, they don't have the resources, they don't have you know, the healthcare or the social worker or whatever it is that, you know, the professional that they could go to, and they don't even know anybody, and they just go online and all of a sudden your video pops up and it speaks to them. I think that's just beautiful. And like, it's just the need for connection and understand that someone out there knows what they're going through and where they've been, you know,
without judgment. Yeah.
Sharing your story is like, you know, freedom for you, but it's helping everybody else.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's what the beautiful part about social media, you know, the internet, especially during these times where we're locked away, and it's the perfect recipe for addiction, you know, isolation, you know, stress, all these things, you know, putting people with their kids 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and not letting them out of their house. It's a difficult time. And, you know, and if you've reached a few people, that's just, I mean, it's so beautiful. Like, I mean, yeah, that's why you're crying. 'Cause it's amazing. You know, to reach out and, you know, help people reach their full potential is,
That's it. That's what I want to do. Because yeah. So I just thought, you know, I want to do this. I want to do more of this in a more professional capacity. And the ladies that inspired me, Kate and Mandy, have now their own community called Love Sober. And they've written a book called Love Yourself Sober, which is, you know, it's mainly aimed at mums. It's going back to what you were talking about, you know, the alcohol being marketed to mums, and me saying about self-care. So their book is all about that, you know, stopping drinking, but also looking at all the other pieces about being a mum that also takes care of herself, and not just the kids. So I went back to them and said, like, I'm really inspired by this. I really think I want to do something. Where did you train? Because they are both coaches with an organization called She Recovers, which started in the States. And I kind of remember Mandy went on a workshop, a retreat thing, which sounded amazing. Can you tell me about the training? And they said, well, you know what? We're running our own course. We're teaching a course in addictive behaviors coaching in conjunction with the Coaching Academy. And you could do our course, but it's like a bolt-on. You have to do life coaching as well. I was like, oh, shit, when's your course happening? And they were like, oh, February. And so this was like late January I was talking to them. First weekend and second weekend in February. And I'm like, oh, no, but I haven't done the life coaching. And they said, well, contact them and maybe you can just do both. So I was like, well, okay, I'll do that. I signed up both the life coaching and the addictive behaviors training. And then I listened to one of their podcasts. Another amazing inspirational lady called Stephanie Shivers, who has worked in addiction therapy. You know, she's worked in prison, she's worked with children, she's worked in rehab. She really knows her stuff. She does like a one-day training for brief intervention. Because I was getting contacted by our people who identified as alcoholics asking me for help. I'm like, I don't know what the fuck I'm doing. This is like a little bit scary. And I was having to say, I'm really sorry. That's not my experience. And I could give like a website, drinkaware.com in the UK, or I could suggest finding a meeting. But I felt really ill-equipped for some of the people that were contacting me on social media. So I did her training, like a day's online course, and just, yeah, learned about all the signs of sudden withdrawal, the dangers, you know, learned, you know, the risks of combining alcohol, you know, with other depressants, and just felt a little bit more able to field some questions and signpost on, you know, like onward referral. And mostly it's like, if you feel you could be at risk of sudden withdrawal, you need to consult a medical professional. You need to speak to a doctor. Don't just stop drinking if you are, you know, a regular heavy drinker. And it was really important to me to know that part, you know. And I often, if anyone contacts me via DM, I have to ask for my own peace of mind. Because, yeah, I've heard stories about, you know, young people dying in withdrawal from alcohol, and it's just heartbreaking.
Well, I mean, here during the early pandemic, they made alcohol sales as an essential service, and people are like, well, why is that essential service? Well, if you take it away from, say, I don't know how, what's the percentage of the population, but a number, quite a large number of people, they may die, you know? And so, you know, you just think of that and those numbers and, you know, it's a very dangerous place where you could just, if you stop it, you know, if you're not medically supervised. Yeah. So, you know, always contact your healthcare professionals and, you know, there's so many resources here in Canada. We have such a great resource for detox and medical detox. And we have universal healthcare like you guys do in the UK there. So, I mean, there's always a place where you can go and, you know, it is so important to understand the risks of stopping surrounding that. It's a very dangerous thing.
Yeah.
You know, I think I could talk to you for hours. It's just, you're such a great, talker. And
talk a lot.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's perfect for me. I can just sit back and listen and, you know, it's such a great story. You know, it's different from mine because I mean, I needed help to stop and I needed help to stopped. And, you know, you've had 3 years of sobriety, which is like, for me, I'm like, how did you do that? But that gray area, I think there's so many people that fit into that gray area, where drinking, it's not going to cause death maybe, or not going to cause them to lose everything, but it's still a problem. And I think there's more people finding themselves in that situation during this, crazy time we're in.
Yeah. and I think you touched on it before, you know, the advice now is from the new science that we have that there is no safe level of drinking. There is no safe level. It, you know, it just is a question of how much risk you want to take and how much time you want to knock off your life. You know, it might just be months or it might be years or it might be decades. Someone, you know, pulled me on that, but we all drink, but you know, it's what we've always done. And yeah, it's good for stress. And now I can say, actually, you know, it's not. and the NHS website is updated and it states that there is no safe level of drinking, but so many people don't know still, they still think that it's good for you and red wine's good for you. And there's a lot of misinformation.
Well, yeah, and it's misinformation or just misunderstanding, you know, and it's big marketing campaign. Yeah. As you work for a marketing company, you know, it's just, you know, it's selling things and it's big business. So. So how can people find you if they're looking for you? I'll put the descriptions in the podcast description where to find you, but it's Nancy at Sober Loving Radical on TikTok and Instagram, and also put your email in the show description. And I'd like to thank you for taking the time today to speak with me, and I had a great time.
It's lovely to chat. I love what you're doing. I've listened to all of the podcasts you've done, and I'm really, really stoked. That is not even an English term. I don't know where that came from. But yeah, I'm really happy to have been part of it. Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you. And I'd love to have you back on someday soon. So
yeah, it'd be great.
Okay, well, talk soon.
Yeah. Thanks, Rhett. Bye.
Thanks for listening to the PhD podcast. It doesn't matter how you got here or why you got here. I have so much gratitude that you've taken some time off your planet to spend some time on mine. Subscribe, follow along at planetret.com. Reach out and join this community. PhD, if you have a problem with drugs or alcohol, get sober and stay sober. It's worth it.